Would you like an opinion on a financial matter you're dealing with? Whether it's about retirement, investments, taxes, or 401ks, Scott Hansen and Pat McClain would like to help you by answering your call. To join Allworth's Money Matters, call now at 833-99-WORTH. That's 833-99-W-O-R-T-H.
Welcome to Allworth's Money Matters. Scott Hansen.
Pat McClain, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, glad you're with us as we talk about the world of finance. We're both practicing advisors, and
we meet with people similar to you.
And we've been doing this show for almost 30 years, helping people with their...
Long time. All right, so Scott, there's a couple things I want to talk about in the world of finance, which is the S&P 500 exits the longest bear market since 1948.
I saw that headline. I'm like, the longest bear market.
In terms of length of time, I guess. And there were no bells or announcements when it exited. There were lots when it entered. And then the other thing I want to talk about, which I found fascinating, which are these zombie mortgages.
I read that article as well.
Zombie mortgages. I found that absolutely. I think I keep up on this stuff, but when I read this article, well, let's talk about it now.
Yeah.
Okay.
S&P, the bear market's boring. This is pretty interesting.
This is really interesting.
Because the markets go through ups and downs.
It's going to happen.
Yeah.
I mean, and remember, let's finish up on the S&P 500. It goes up and down, up and down. It enters the bear market. If yes,
whatever bear market is.
Yeah,
it's a made-up term. Yeah, I would make it up.
So it's up 20% from its bottom. But who in the midst of all the turmoil that's going on in the political environment, the economic environment, the bear market comes to an end? Blah, blah, blah. All right. Now.
And this means nothing either. If you look at the S&P 500, after exiting a bear market, which we just did about a week or two ago, on average, the one-year return is 9.3%. That's the average. The median is 13.1%, and it's positive 61% of the time. Well, guess how often the market's positive?
Okay.
61% of the time. And what's the long-term average? 10%.
Like, here we go. So thank you.
Nothing.
Thank you. So these.
And by the way, anytime you think you found something with some correlation, it's gone.
These are zombie mortgages. Zombie mortgages are. This goes back years and years during the great financial crisis when many homes went into foreclosure or loans were reworked.
Yeah. So think back. This is really interesting. Right? If you think back to the early 2000s, mid-2000s, before the financial crisis, that's where a lot of these came from, right? And people were buying homes. If you remember back, fog a mirror. You don't even need to fog a mirror. If you can just sign a document.
Yeah, they called them liar loans or no documentation loans.
And oftentimes, people would use a first and a second to get the loan.
And they called them piggybacks.
Yeah. Or you saw people They put nothing down on a house. The house went up in value. A year and a half later, they took a big line of credit on it so they can buy a boat and a Cadillac Escalade or whatever, right?
Right.
That's the kind of thing that was happening before the financial crisis. The financial crisis hit.
And many people reworked their mortgages.
Existing mortgage.
And thought that the second mortgage just went away because they no longer made payments.
And what happened?
On them.
So let's say a house was, let's say someone paid $300,000. Now, let's say they paid $400,000 for a house and they financed, let's assume they financed 100% of it back in the day, right? So $400,000 loan. And then let's assume a year later they took out a $100,000 home equity loan because the house
went
was
up
worth
in value.
$600,000.
Yes.
That's exactly the stuff that went on, right? Then the market tanked. Home values fell to 350, and the homeowner's like, wait a minute, the house is worth less than the mortgage balance. They went to the loan company, said, you need to rework this loan, otherwise we're going to walk away.
And that was the first loan.
Correct. So they'd worked with the bank. The bank said, okay, we're going to lower your principal amount, and here's the new payment, because the bank didn't want to have the house go into foreclosure. But the second, the line of credit or the second mortgage, they're second in line, so there was no equity left.
They're like, what do we do?
They did nothing.
They did nothing. other...
Including communicating that we still have a lien on your house.
Yes. Like, this debt still exists.
That lien was never removed from title. That lien still remained.
And in fact, not only did that lien remain...
They just gave up trying to get payments from people.
The interest rate kept accruing on that loan 10 years? 12 years? What did that mortgage company do with that loan? What did the financiers do with that loan? Oftentimes, they sold them for 6 cents on the dollar, 7 cents on the dollar, 8 cents on the dollar to other finance companies. And why would this company buy a $100,000 mortgage, second mortgage on a house that had no equity and pay $6,000 for it or $7,000?
Well, they know that there's going to be maybe one out of 10 they're going to be able to collect on.
And at some point in time, those people are going to stay in that home.
And the home's going to increase in value, and there might be equity again.
And there might be equity again.
And that's where we are today.
And so, people are now getting contacted by people, a lending institution that they borrowed money from for a second loan, second mortgage, third mortgage, line of credit that's 15 years old. And are being told, hey, you know that 100 grand you borrowed? You owe it to us now. And it's not 100 grand. It's $240,000. Oh, and by the way, we're going to foreclose on your house. Do you know why? Because you've paid down that first mortgage.
And now there's equity. So you either pay us or...
Or you work out a payment plan or we're going to take this house.
And some of these people,
Predatory.
Oh yeah, I mean, I wouldn't want to be in that. Personally, wouldn't want to be in that business. It sounds nasty. Yeah,
yes.
But I understand why it exists. But part of the problem for some of these people, Pat, is that loans oftentimes are resold in the secondary market to a servicing company. So you might have gotten a loan from one of the big Quicken or whatever, and it could have been sold, particularly back in the day, sold to a servicing company. Well, some of these people, it was the same servicing company did the first and the second. And so when they went through the process dealing with ABC Financial on having ABC Financial rework their loan, they assumed it included both the first and the second. And then because the second quit, they even quit mailing to them.
They just said, what's the point?
But that lien never left. And that
like that Washington debt,
that signature that somebody put when they took the money, that was then recorded on the property, that never went away.
It's a lien on the property. So you might have borrowed money from Washington Mutual thinking, Washington Mutual?
They went bankrupt.
They sold the Bank of America. Oh, by the way, they worked my loan out. They may have worked one of your loans out. But this will be interesting to watch. Watch what will happen.
And if you're listening and you think, I wonder if that impacts me or one of my family
members.
You
can go and look it up.
Just do a search on your, see what liens are on your property.
That's right.
That's public record.
Yes, you can look it up. You can look it up. So, I found it just absolutely, like, fascinating. I thought to myself, this is amazing. These guys are that patient that, The investors that bought these.
Well, no one's gonna just throw them away.
Well, that's a good point. No one right? Just said shred them.
I mean, think about if you're the mortgager. Because obviously we're all thinking it right now from the homeowner because it
that's
sounds
right.
Disastrous and predatory as I used to. But you think about it from the finance company.
They lent the money.
They put all this money and they had to take a loss, Pat, from $100,000. Now the thing they're like, we're probably not gonna get anything out of it. But why would they just walk away completely? They're going to market to market, so they're going to say they're going to take a financial loss internally.
But we can get something out of this.
And if there's someone out there that's going to say, I'll give you a penny,
well, it's more than they have now.
So you're going to sell it, and then that person, the company who bought it, like...
Well, that was my point, is the company that bought it, they're very, very patient investors.
And... I remember when I was in college, I had a friend of mine, his family owned a collection company, and it was medical debts, and he worked at that part-time.
That's got to be hard.
I remember the time thinking, that's not the business I'd want to be in. I couldn't, and his job was to call people. Yeah, I know we went through all that stuff, right? Like, that's just...
Yeah.
But... So, do a search if you think that could be you, because that's not... And my guess is it'll work its way through. But it's amazing how real estate prices, home prices, for the most part, around the country, have held up.
It is. We talked about it on the show a few weeks ago. It's perplexing.
I mean, there's a handful of markets we're seeing some declines, primarily the coasts, the liberal areas of the coasts, mostly the big cities and stuff. Not the Beltway,
the Sun Belt.
The Sun Belt. Yeah. Anyway, nobody can predict.
You can't predict
any markets over a short period of time. All right, we're going to take some calls. If you want to join us, and we love taking calls because it's. I just find people interesting. One of the reasons I got in this business, you get a combined finance, which I always enjoyed, along with people, which I find people fascinating and their situations interesting. And if you've got something you're trying to deal with, maybe someone's recommending something to you and you're wondering if it's the right thing, maybe something you've been pondering, maybe you're stuck, whatever. We'd love to take your call. You could either send us an email with that question and we'll schedule a time at questions@moneymatters.com. Again, questions@moneymatters.com. Or you can call this number, 833-99-WORTH, and get you set up that way as well. Let's start off here in Arizona talking to James. James, you're with Allworth's Money Matters.
Hi. So I guess my question would be, seeing on the news what's going on with the banks these days, I was wondering if you had, let's say, over $250,000 in one bank, should I be moving some of that money around? Because the way I understand it is you're only insured up to $250,000 in each bank?
Kind of. Kind of.
So it's per beneficiary of the account.
Yeah. So it's the owners of the account times the number of beneficiaries, not to exceed 4 beneficiaries. So what that means is, if you are a single person, let's say, and you have a trust in the bank CD.
Let's assume there's no trust. Most people don't have a trust. Okay. Even people with money who need trust don't. A lot of people don't have them.
So. Okay, so it's 250. But if there's a joint owner on the account, then it's 500.
And then if you have a trust, and let's say it's just your traditional family, husband and wife and 2 kids,
then it's $1 million.
Then it's $1 million.
Yeah, it's 2 owners times the number of beneficiaries times 250,000. So, now in saying that, are you married?
I am not.
Okay. And how much do you have in any one institution?
So I have a small business. I have basically a business checking, business That's savings, just... personal checking, personal savings. I have an IRA and a stock portfolio. All of that in total, last time I checked, was about $442,000.
Okay, so the IRA, is it through the same banking institution?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so that doesn't have, is it in bank CDs or is it invested more in equities, stocks, bonds, mutual funds, something like that?
So the IRA, I'm not too sure about. I've been looking at my IRA and I always thought that, like, if you put money in the IRA, it was going to sort of grow a little bit. You get something on your money back. It seems like my IRA is just sort of has the money that I put in it. I believe it's a traditional IRA.
So an IRA is a title. It's a part of the tax code.
Like an umbrella.
Like an umbrella. The investment that you put inside that is completely up to you within some boundaries. My guess is that you have it in a bank IRA in a regular savings account. It's the wrong place for it, by the way, 100%. How old are you?
So I'm 49 now.
100% the wrong place for you. Absolutely the wrong place.
Because it's never, you're just going to get interest. Yeah. It's not going to be real.
Yeah. So you need, if you're not comfortable actually doing it yourself, then you need to hire someone. I wouldn't hire the financial advisor that sat in the bank branch, but to go out.
That's what I have right now.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And that's one of the reasons why I called you, because I was going to call him and ask him some things, but my concern was that he's with the bank.
That's right.
Itself.
Yeah, he's going to sell you, he or she is probably going to sell you an annuity for that IRA if they haven't already.
So, what would you suggest? I've been putting the max in every year because it helps with my taxes.
Yeah, and you need money for retirement.
Right.
You're probably not. even if you'd like to run your business forever, there might come a day when you
And you
no
said
longer.
You're 49?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I would go all equities. I'd buy the total market at a minimum. How much money's in the IRA?
I think it's 38,000-ish right now. I pretty much just started it a few years ago.
Okay.
So I've been putting the max in.
How many employees do you have?
Actually, it's just me.
Okay. All right. Well, there's lots of things you can do. If you need to save more money, you can set up what's called a simple 401k. A self-employed 401k. But there's another name for it.
We're both blanking out on the name now.
But you could set up
individual 401k, solo-K.
Solo-K, that's right. So you could set up a solo-K, which allows higher limits, and then you could possibly make contributions to a Roth IRA or non-deductible IRA and then convert it to a Roth. And a financial advisor will walk you through that. It's not going to be the bank broker. Most bank brokers just sell product.
Okay.
In terms of that money there, that would be under a different account or ownership for the FDIC. So let's just talk about the money you have in the bank. You can go. Okay. Is it a small regional bank?
No, it's a fairly large bank. Well-known bank, yeah.
Okay, like a J.P. Morgan or a Bank of America or something along those lines, or Wells
something
Fargo.
Something along those lines, yes.
Okay. I wouldn't worry too much if I was a little bit over the limit there.
Okay.
Do you borrow money at all from the bank?
No, sir.
Okay.
There are banks that'll use, what do they call that program? They get reciprocal insurance on it. And we had someone on the show a couple months ago, Kristen Snelling, I think.
They call it FITS or SITS.
I was going to say, basically, you're saying, so with the money I have in there, I shouldn't stress out about what's going on.
How much over the 250 limit are you?
Like I said, it's in total about $442,000.
All right,
altogether.
I don't know why you actually.
You keep any more than 250 in one?
I do not. That's what I was just saying. But we do as a firm,
because it's impossible not to when you have working capital, payroll, or whatever.
That's right. We do as a firm, but we use a bank that actually segregates it into different banks. So we put it in our bank, and they actually invest it in another bank and another bank, and it's this reciprocity which moves the FDIC insurance way up,
which most regional banks do. And it had Silicon Valley Bank set up their depositors that'd still be in business today.
That's right; they would still be in business.
So, real question: I have about in my stock portfolio, I've put about $150,000 in there. I was going to put some more in this year, but because of what's going on with the economy and everything, I pretty much lost all the money that I made.
No, Jane. You made it when?
Over when?
Well, without getting into politics, when Trump was president, I made quite a bit of money. And then as soon as Biden took over, I've lost pretty much everything I made. Some of the principal went down and then it came back. I understand it's going to do that. But would you suggest me putting more in?
No, James, here's what you need. You need a financial advisor because you've got your world upside down. That money that's invested in the market should be in the 401k.
Or IRA.
Or IRA. And the money that should be out of the market, if that's the appropriate thing, is the money that you're using in your brokerage account. And you're not using all the tax benefit that is provided to you as a self-employed individual that you could. You quite frankly, need some professional guidance. And it's not going to take place from the bank. It's not going to take place from the
because
bank.
Because you can contribute to your retirement more than what you're just putting in the IRA. And like when the best time to be buying financial assets are when it's really murky out, when it looks scary, when things aren't doing well, when there's concerns, because prices are depressed at that time. Those are the best times to be buying, not selling.
But
over the long period of time, so James, I'm 56. I started in this industry July of 1990. Okay. So 33 years I've been in this industry. When I started, and the reason I'm telling you this is because why I'm such a big fan of long-term investing. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, when I started, was roughly 2,600. Today, it's roughly, 33,000, give or take, somewhere, depending on the day. So it's more than 10x, no, 15x, over that last 30-some years. That's with all kinds of ups and downs. The dot-com thing, 9/11, financial crisis, you name
but,
it.
But
quantitative easing, inflation, all that stuff.
We'll agree on that. Your allocations, where you have them, where you have them sitting in your portfolios, is completely backwards. It you need a professional to sit down to say, okay, what are we trying to achieve? Where is your money now? By the way, you're wanting you recognize the benefit of an IRA, but you could put a lot more money into a solo K than you can an IRA.
But you might want to some years and maybe not other years. You can have that flexibility.
And how's that money being invested in your brokerage account? Is it tax efficient or not tax efficient? Or is that the right thing for you? And by the way you've just described this $440,000, it doesn't, if you have some money in your brokerage account, that is not the same as having money in the bank. It's not an FDIC insured product. If you have a money in an IRA, that is a different account ownership than you as an individual for FDIC insurance. So my guess is, I'm having a hard time trying to figure out where all these allocations are, is that you're not over the limit because you don't have any one individual account over $250,000.
Okay, so it's per account. So are we saying
it's not per account per bank for it, one bank?
It is titled. It's the title, but
go to the IRA is a different title.
And the IRA is a different title. And so
I don't know if that's right or not on the IRA.
I'm gonna check.
I've never advised a client to have an IRA.
Well, that's a good point. Well, that's my point. That's my point anyway.
Account, so.
That it makes your asset allocation location is it's crazy. Yeah, just go and hire a professional advisor. Pay them by the hour or pay them as a percentage of the portfolio, but hire someone to actually fix the main thing, which is what should I buy, when and why and where, right?
Okay.
And you want a fee-based advisor, not a commission-based advisor. You go to a bank and that person sitting over in the corner, lovely as they may be, 85%+ of the time they are commission-based.
That's the way I understand it. He told me he doesn't make money unless I make money.
All right, maybe he's fee-based.
That's not true.
But that's not
true.
Well, that's not
really
true.
No, I've never met an advisor that even the hedge funds make money when they lose their clients' money. No, there's no one out there that only makes money when a client makes money.
Yeah. Well, they make more money when the client makes more money.
That's right.
They make more money.
Their interest might be aligned.
What, like us as a firm, we make more money when our clients make more money. And when our clients make less money or lose money, we make less money or don't get paid as much.
But I remember having a conversation years ago with the client. They said, why don't you just charge me? I don't mind paying you and we make money. But those years that I don't make money, how about you don't charge me? And I said, well, if the markets go down roughly 1 out of 3 years, how in the world can I have a company that operates when you've got payroll and whatnot? I mean, it's just, that's not a realistic.
Anyway, you know,
that's why there's no advisor that works that way.
You know what to do.
Yeah.
James, appreciate the call.
Yeah, glad to call you. And it's, Pat, it's this whole FDIC thing.
Makes no sense to me.
If you look back, if you think back to the financial crisis, it was this too big to fail, right? And the idea was, we don't want banks. We don't want any bank to be so large they're too big to fail. We're better off having a variety of different institutions across the country so that if one goes out, it's not going to tank the economy. And instead, where we are today, too big not to fail means you are so large, you are pretty much guaranteed government backstop.
We will not fail. We will not allow you to fail. And so what we saw with Silicon Valley Bank is because the regulations had changed in terms of their deposits and how they're regulated, they fell below this threshold, but they were still way too big. How is the number 16th largest bank in the U.S. not considered large, which was what Silicon Valley was, right? Top 20. And so after that, what we're seeing is that there is a flight away from small regional banks to big banks.
Yeah.
The J.P. Morgans, the Wells Fargo's, the Bank of America. This is not good for local economies. This is terrible. Where you don't know your banker, you don't know your lender. Business is done between people. You might think it, but and the closer you are
to the big bank, the representative of the big banks would argue that they have relationships. They have local people.
They certainly do. I mean, look at all the people that went in and scooped up all the bankers out of Silicon Valley when they blew up.
That's right.
Right? But taking the money out of the local economy and putting it in a large national bank is not the same.
I do think having a differentiation between individual private money and like corporate money, particularly like payroll. Like companies need to use a financial intermediary to deal with the payroll. So man, think about a large company when you've got hundreds of millions of dollars in payroll. A week. So like, how do you have FDIC limit? What happens if your bank freezes the day that, right in the middle of the transfer? Those things need to get worked out. We don't have the answers here. Nobody quite does. But anyway, we're taking a quick break. We'll continue back with calls. This is All Worth Money Matters.
Can't get enough of All Worth's Money Matters? Visit allworthfinancial.com/radio to listen to the Money Matters podcast.
Welcome back to All Worth's Money Matters. Scott Hansen here.
Pat McClain.
Let's continue with calls. We're talking with Jay in California. Jay, you're with All Worth's Money Matters.
Hi there.
Hey, Jay.
So I retired a few months ago at 60 and have been talking to different advisors and planners. And I've got a couple of things I'm trying to sort out. And you know, one of them is recommendations for, you know, the registered index-linked annuities to help reduce risk on my portfolio. And then the other question I have is just sort of what's a reasonable fraction of sort of assets to allocate towards long-term care. Those are the two things I'm currently working on.
Okay.
So you're age 60. You just retired. Where's your income coming from right now?
So my wife is 5 years younger. She's working still till 60. I have a pension, and then I'm also doing a bit of a draw on a near-term cash bucket just to kind of keep income at what it was prior to retirement.
And how your pension? What percentage of your income is your pension replacing? Your pre-retirement income, ballpark.
Our total. It's probably it was about. It is, say, 40% of our total income.
And so how much is your monthly pension right now?
Monthly pension is about $8,300.
And how much were you earning at your job?
Probably $20,000 a month.
And are you eligible for Social Security? Your home paid for?
We still have a mortgage at 3%.
Okay.
Or so.
And how much money do you have in investable assets, in IRAs, 401ks, that sort of thing?
It's about 1.45 million.
Why do you want an indexed annuity?
I've had it proposed by a couple of different places. And it was recommended as, securing more income and reducing risk, like a sequence of return kind of risk. I think we
were
have,
these two or, people you talked to, were they certified financial planners? Were they securities licensed? Did they,
I think
have
they
manage money for fee?
Yeah. So one was from, sort of a money management, firm, and I'm pretty sure he was a CFP, and then I know the other person is a CFP but works at an insurance company. So.
Okay. And what – so what I'm trying to determine is, are you worried about the volatility, or are they making you worried about the volatility in the marketplace? Because you acquired this $1.45 million over many, many years, and my assumption is that – you were invested in equities or stocks at some point in time. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, pretty much up until after I retired, actually, because it did go down a big chunk, the years or whatever it was ago. And so that kind of was a kind of wake up to maybe put more of it in a safer place, but it was pretty much all equities the whole time I was working.
And how much? And how is it allocated today? The $1.45 million. How much is allocated toward stocks, and how much is allocated toward bonds?
There's about $300K in a near-term money market bucket that I'm drawing in right now for sort of near-term for
okay.
the next 5 years, and then the rest is like it's probably 60-40, 70-30 managed chunk, $1.1 million.
I like it.
I do too.
I like it. I like it.
Mm-hmm. I'm here. So here,
let's just explain how yeah. indexed annuities work.
I'm not a big fan of index annuities.
Let's explain how they work.
So when you buy an index annuity, there are different types of annuities. There's lots of different types of annuities. They're not necessarily good or bad. It depends how they're used. I've often said the world would have been better if they were never created because they are so often missold. But and there's so many garbage annuity products out there. But with an equity index annuity, when you buy that annuity, you give up control of your capital. So let's say you put $100,000 in. You give that $100,000 to the insurance company. The insurance company is now part of the insurance company's assets, becomes liability to them, right? But it's on their books. They, in turn, go out and invest it. They put the majority of it in really safe type investments. Then they take some very small portion of it and buy options on typically the S&P 500. There's sometimes it's different index.
Yeah, but sometimes they create their own indexes.
Yeah, and so and then as far as the return from the investor when you buy this annuity, it's almost impossible for the average person to understand exactly where the returns are coming from. Every contract's a little different, insurance companies are different. But essentially they say, look, we're going to guarantee your principal. We're going to guarantee you some sort of return. But you're going to need to guarantee to us that you're locking up your money for 7 years, 10 years, 12 years, 15 years, 19 years. And then you'll have your principal guaranteed, maybe some small interest, and then your returns are going to be linked to the returns of this other index.
Which, by the way, oftentimes ignores dividends.
And typically has caps on the upsides.
So you only participate in 60% or 70%.
And caps on the percentage in any one particular 12-month period. There's all kinds of strange caps because for the insurance company, like, the majority of it's sitting out there in conservative investments. They just take a very small portion to buy options. There's no way they're going to be able to get the same kind of return they'd have in the plain market because they've got all these other costs associated.
So what you're doing is you're buying an insurance for downside, and that insurance comes at a cost. And my question I always ask is, why? Why? What's the point of buying the insurance if, in fact, I believe that any downturn in the market will be temporary? And if it is, in fact, temporary, why do I need to insure against loss for a short period of time, especially if my time frame is 20 years, 30 years, 35 years between you and your wife? You're 60, she's 55, right? That puts her at 90.
There are some in the industry's change. Here, one of the other reasons I don't like equity index annuities is the commissions that get paid to the salesperson. So the salesperson's commissions are 4%, 5%, 8%, 10%, 12% commissions paid to an advisor or an insurance salesperson at the time of the transaction. Massive commissions. So suddenly this person who sold you the product, they got paid a bunch of money up front. As life continues on, your complexity and your financial life continues, they've already been compensated. So they're not going to be financially motivated to come along your side and help you with other problems. But there are some companies out there that have insurance products that can just go on a typical investment account. They don't, inside with ETFs, you don't have to lock your money up into sort of insurance. And you just put the insurance on. There's a cost.
Yeah, and it gets repriced every year. So we've told you how we feel about, and by the way, we've seen the aftermath. I remember the retired doctor coming into our office with $1.8 million worth of indexed annuities sold to him all by the same advisor wanting to know how to exit them.
Which you couldn't.
Which we couldn't exit them without a considerable amount of pain. How much money are you taking in monthly distribution? So you said you have 5 years of cash set aside, which is $300,000. which I'm not super good at math, but it tells me you're taking about $5,000 a month in income out of this?
Yeah, out of the near-term cash bucket. Yeah.
Got it.
Have you ran some projections over the next 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 30 years in retirement?
Yeah, I've tried several of the softwares, and I like doing that to see that just how, at least projection-wise, some of these different options, you know, increase your projected chance of success or money at the end, even though realizing it's just a kind of a long-term guess. But yeah, I use those a lot.
So, by the way, so you're taking over a little bit over a 4% distribution. Absolutely fine. My guess is when Social Security kicks in, you can lower that so that your income will stay relatively stable throughout that. So then you're going to move it back to about a 3% distribution when Social Security kicks in. Your allocation of 60-40, 70-30, I cannot see in my lifetime why an annuity would help you. Now,
if you want insurance, there's other ways to go about it besides equity index.
Yeah. So, but then you talked about long-term care, did you not?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. I've been trying to, I know there's I feel a little bit of time, pressure wise, just age wise. And,
You never know what comes tomorrow, right?
Yeah. So
once you need it, you can't buy it. It's kind of like your house is on fire. You're not going to get fire insurance.
So I've been trying to think of it as, okay, I've got this much assets. How much of it should I allocate to this? And, I'm kind of leaning towards, maybe a 10 to 15% max if just looking at the quotes, because I've talked to a bunch of long-term or several long-term care.
So what have you seen? Like, what is the most appealing long-term care policy that you've seen?
I like the cash indemnity ones because it gives you the sense of you can kind of use it for whatever you need it for. But I think the best buy for the money are sort of the traditional insurances. Like One America has like a, couple second to die death benefit, and the cost is, maybe 100, and they can split it up either, a chunk up front and then so much for 10 to 20 years or whatever. So I've been leaning towards some.
And how long?
Check up front.
How long of pay? How long is the payout?
Those are the cash balance ones, right?
Yeah. So it kind of ranges. We've looked at sort of maybe 4 or 5 years, and the one I mentioned, they have a couple of them have unlimited options once you sort of used up the death benefit for not a whole lot.
More. So if you had if you and your wife had, let's just call it a normal. End of life care experience, which is kind of what we're talking about here. You have plenty of assets and income to cover those things. Your pension's $8,300 a month.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, you're going to have Social Security. So you're going to have plenty of households income to cover a kind of a normal couple year need of long-term care. Mm-hmm. Where it could be damaged, where it's could be really problematic is if suddenly something happens to one of you, it's a 15-year Alzheimer thing.
Yeah.
Wait, right? And so it's the shorter term you can self-insure for. It's the longer term that can be problematic. So if I were in your situation looking at I my whole focus would be on that risk that is hard, the risk that would really hit you hard.
Mm-hmm.
It's like an automobile. It's not the fender benders that are a big deal, right? Like no one mm-hmm. likes that, but you can pay. It's if you something to some massive liability that you have the insurance for. And I think of it kind of the same way here.
So, and Jay, do you have money outside the IRA that you would fund that with?
Not really.
So you'd set it up on monthly payments?
Yeah, I think monthly or maybe a 10 or 20 year pay.
Okay, all right.
I'm leaning towards a limited time payment.
I like where you're going with this. I like, yep.
Okay.
Yep. And look, you can't do everything. So don't insure the downside in the market. Just live with it. But insure the long-term care.
Okay.
And just because look, these index annuities, just because you can't see the fee doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
Okay.
Yeah, it is. People tell me, well, they don't cost anything. I'm like, yeah, you know how benevolent insurance companies are. We all know that.
I mean, are you guys more fans of like a time bucket approach for covering the downside periods? Or,
no, it's, to me, it's all, we look at it, it's income needs, so it's time horizon and risk tolerances.
And income needs. So what you get to the same place by rebalancing the portfolio on a monthly, quarterly, weekly basis. Once you set your allocation, the reason people use the buckets of money or the time bucket thing is it's psychological. It doesn't do anything to help the portfolio. In fact, if you had this $300, $100,000 sitting in cash, I would ask you, what kind of cash is that in?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah, right now it's in a money market.
Well, which is a terrible place for it to be. Mm-hmm. You're giving up yield and for no reason. Because you said it's 5 years. And so if I kept my portfolio consistent at a 70-30 and I knew that we had something short in the term in the portfolio, which is yielding higher than cash, you're going to be well served. In fact, it would be less expensive for you to hire an advisor to do that than the yield you're giving up mm-hmm. by keeping it in just in a cash account, which is probably paying 0.3% or 30 basis points or 0.5%. So that's buckets of money is a psychological 70-30 gets you at the same. You go to the, are you retired from the federal government of the state of California?
Not federal government.
Okay.
But,
so if we looked at that pension that was sending you that money every month, they don't have a bucket of money set up that says, you know, we've got 5 years of Jay's income in here. Mm-hmm. What they're doing is they're rebalancing the portfolio on an ongoing basis and then deciding what to sell every time they send you a check. That's how it works. So sometimes you're selling equities and sometimes you're selling bonds, but you're trying to actually keep that portfolio to 70-30 or around there.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So anyway, I think you're on the right track and stay away from anyone that's trying to sell you an index annuity.
Okay.
All righty.
Very good.
All right. Appreciate the call.
Yeah. Thanks for calling. It's how do I say this really kindly? There are people that could really benefit from having a relationship with an advisor that is a competent advisor they can trust. It'd be well money spent.
I agree.
And it's
I just can't the whole life, I can't understand why anyone would think that that was a good alternative for Jay. I just can't. I just don't know why.
Yes, you do.
Well, not for Jay. I didn't say that was a good alternative for Jay. It was a good alternative for the person selling the product, but it wasn't a good alternative for Jay.
I don't like any sort of financial product where an advisor gets paid a big upfront commission and very little or nothing typically and ongoing. What kind of relationship with that? Would you want a relationship?
This is with your contractor, someone building your home like that?
Would you pay them up front?
Right? Here you go.
Here's the money. Hope it all works out well. Gee, what do you think's going to happen down the road? Those contractors usually have a few different things going on at once, right?
Yes.
That's kind of like, oh, we'll be back on Thursday. What do you mean Thursday? I've got this other problem. So where do you think your house would fall in line?
If you wrote the check all up front?
It's the same thing with an equity index annuity.
Yeah. Actually, this is a tip for the contractors hate this, but when I'm doing any major contracting, I put a date on it and then we agree on one price if they go over that date and another price if they finish by that date. And the reason behind that is if you finish by a particular date, you're going to make more money.
Let me ask you a question.
What's that?
Of the contractors that have worked on your house over the years, how many have been repeat? And do you have
most of them are repeat.
Oh, good. All right.
Most of them are repeat. Most of them. In fact, I talked to one yesterday. Most of them are repeat.
You talked to one yesterday. You're always doing something in your house.
I did talk to one yesterday.
Pat's house is much smaller than when he moved in because they painted it so many times.
I was talking to a painting contractor yesterday. My house has shrunk. The interior of my house has shrunk by
Pat's house is like a, it looks like a, what do you call those, model home. Like, you don't even look like anyone lives there.
We're very clean.
Usually you have a husband and wife. Usually one is a neat freak, the other one's not. They kind of balance each other out. You guys are both like neat freaks, and the house looks like a...
We're very organized.
Very organized. Notice I didn't hear the neat freak. Very organized.
We're very organized.
We're clean and organized.
We're clean and organized. Okay. I just... it's... My mind is cluttered enough with stuff like I need to be clean and organized.
The early years of my marriage, we argued quite a bit because I'm a bit of a neat freak, clean and organized. And my wife is much more relational, let's just say. And I've had to get to the point where...
You give up?
Well, there's certain rooms that I've just...
Oh, like when my kids...
She's not a hoarder, so it's not like there's piles of magazines in the corner or anything. But it's just...
Yeah, the kids just come back from college to stay for a couple of weeks, and I've got to shut his door.
Yeah, just shut the door. That you don't
yeah,
see
just
it.
Shut the door. Yeah,
yeah. I don't go upstairs.
Yeah.
The kids' rooms. I can't go upstairs. I just don't like it. It's not how I like to live. Anyway.
It's almost like it doesn't exist. I live in a one-story house. Oh, upstairs? No idea what's up there.
I do every once in a while. They don't want me upstairs. Teenagers. Dad's coming to my room.
I was going to have the stairs removed.
All right, let's continue with calls here. We're talking with Chuck in California. Chuck, you're with Allworth's Money Matters.
Hi, guys.
Hi, Chuck.
Hi. So my question is about planning for Medicare costs, specifically any surcharges. So I just turned 60 a few months ago, and I'm planning to do Roth conversions as my income is expected to vary over the next few years.
Okay.
Let's back up. What problem are we trying to solve?
I'm planning for Medicare costs, but
on which cost? Are we looking at a supplemental Medicare plan you're going to buy when you're 65, or you're thinking about the Medicare premium that goes up as your income goes up in retirement?
Yes, the last part there.
Okay, okay.
The Medicare surcharge.
Yeah, okay. So you could be paying anywhere from people, and I'm just explaining this out for it's a broad audience. You could be paying anywhere from $125 a month, roughly, to $500 a month, roughly, depending on your income. So the higher the income, the higher your Medicare cost.
Which then leads to your question about Roth conversion. So fire away.
Exactly, because I've got some control over my AGI over the next few years as I approach that age. So I want to manage my Roth conversions with an eye on the medical surcharges that will be coming up.
Okay.
So I'm going to turn 65 in September of 2027. And so I want to try to figure out what tax years are correlated with the Medicare costs. So is it the 2025 tax year that impacts my costs the first few months that I go on Medicare, being September to December of 2027? And then in January 2028, is it going to look at the next tax year, 2026?
Wow. You know, actually,
it's the 12 months prior.
Yes, but there can be an adjustment it's an estimate.
It's an estimate, there's
a true-up.
I don't remember which year it is.
Okay.
So it's a true-up.
It's a rolling period, right? So it's a rolling look-back period is what I'm trying to...
Yeah, and here's our experience. So those in retirement retirement age, because sometimes people are still working, but those that are stuck paying this higher Medicare premium are typically such that we might be able to do a little bit of planning around the edges, but we're pretty much just stuck with it because we've got high income. It's the people that have a one-off year. There's a large capital gain or that sort of thing. So tell us about your situation a little more.
Well, because my income is low right now, I'm doing Roth conversions.
Okay.
So it's driving up my AGI. Well, I have control over what my AGI is.
That's correct.
So I'm going to back off.
How much? So how much? I understand what you're. How much are you converting to Roths?
Anywhere from 100 to 150 per year. Kind of depends on.
And are you paying it?
I want to pay.
Right, what tax bracket are you limiting yourself to?
I'm trying to stay in the 22 to 24% federal tax bracket.
Got it.
Right now.
Got it. And are you...
And you're a resident of California.
Yes.
So you're 9%.
And you expect that you're going to stay in California forever?
Probably, yes.
Okay. And how much money do you have in IRAs and qualified plans?
I don't know, 1.5-2 million.
Married?
Yes.
Children?
Yes, adult children.
Got it. Well, I like where you're going.
Kind of. But there's so many moving factors. And this is to assume that they're not going to make changes to the Medicare premiums.
But
5 years out.
Yes. But and let's say you were.
I like the concept of if you're in a lower tax bracket, taxes all considered, and that's Medicare taxes, one tax.
That's right. So if when you do these conversions and you get to Medicare, what will your income be that year following, assuming no Roth conversions?
It'll probably be pretty low. So, it's just going to be.
What's low?
Investment income. So I'm probably going to be under the whatever's under the 22% bracket.
So that's what
I don't remember.
That's
a 12% bracket. Now we're talking about a 10% differential,
which is why you've so that this is.
And we're talking about a few thousand dollars a year of Medicare taxes, and you're looking at paying more than 10%.
Yes.
More in taxes.
So that's where you've got to – I think you might actually be one of the few people that are actually considering doing too much of a Roth conversion.
Oh, okay.
Right? So think about it this way, because you're focused on this Medicare, and what I'm going to ask you to do is focus on the world.
Yeah.
And I would step back and do an analysis of what my income coming from my IRAs are in the year in which I start Medicare, my Social Security – and then money coming out of the Roth. My guess is that you're doing way too much in Roth conversions between now and age 65 and with the eye on that Medicare tax. And I think there's lots of
moving parts, lots of other taxes. So.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, that's all the time we have in the program. As always, super fun being with everybody. So glad you took your time to join us. If you like this program, do us a favor. Wherever you get your podcast, go and give us a little review. State what you like or don't like about the program. Give us whatever stars you feel are appropriate. And forward it on to a friend that you think could benefit as well. We'll see you next week. This has been Scott Hansen and Pat McLean of Allworth's Money Matters.
This program has been brought to you by Allworth Financial, a registered investment advisory firm. Any ideas presented during this program are not intended to provide specific financial advice. You should consult your own financial advisor, tax consultant, or estate planning attorney to conduct your own due diligence.